Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann. I'll begin with a featured story, the New York Times Magazine. New York's weed rush is here. They came to cash in. For generations, entrepreneurs and dreamers have moved to New York City to strike it big. Now they're coming to sell a lot of cannabis. It's a story by Jamie Lowe. S was 30 and C was 22 when they first met at a focus group for public transportation in Tampa, Florida in 2012. The age difference between them was a problem for her at first. I was like immediately, no, S says. She had already spent a decade trying to figure out her life. There were years spent working on behalf of tomato farm laborers in Florida, followed by a stint as a union rep for janitors and security guards at Harvard in Massachusetts, then jobs as a pastry chef in Boston and in Austin, Texas. But by 2016, she was back in Tampa, her hometown, working in kitchens, still making pastries. She was, in C's words, this beautiful, smart woman who's about this community life. A few months after the focus group, where, as it happened, they were the only two participants who actually used public transportation, she messaged him on Facebook. Hey, question, you know anyone I could cop some weed from? She wanted to make some edibles. He seemed like someone who might be able to provide the key ingredient. Though he was abstaining at the time, worried about the drug testing at his job at a mental health organization, he had used and dealt cannabis since high school. He had some connections. Luckily, where I was hanging out at, my neighbor was an old head, like 70 years or 75 years old, C says. He was selling hella weed. A few weeks later, he sampled one of S's first batches of edibles, green tea madeleines. They were the perfect balance of sweet and earthy, spongy in texture. They did a number on me, C says. S made more desserts, like gummies and dulce de leche cookies. By now, she was no longer worrying about the drug testing at work. He was no longer worrying. He was focused on supplying her cannabis. I'm trying to hang out with her, he says. So I started selling them to people in my neighborhood and really putting some effort in. A partnership in romance, in business, took shape. They sold their goods at the kitchens where she worked and at barber shops, too. We'd bring Rice Krispie treats, but more gourmet. They were shaped in a donut with white chocolate drizzle. Just next-level stuff. Sometimes it'd be like flan or tres leches. We have drinks like guanabana, or sour stop, and like passion fruit, he says, describing some of their cannabis-infused products. It's Tampa, so there are a lot of people from the islands or the Caribbean. Business flourished. By 2020, they had 8 employees and hundreds of customers. They organized cannabis events where they sold edibles, CBD products, and flower, the smokable parts of the plant. When the pandemic hit, they remained committed to their deliveries. Some of their customers were elderly and pain and looking for alternative therapies. We were like Uber Eats, sliding around the streets after the curfews, he says. They considered themselves, and their customers considered them, essential workers. But despite the fact that there was a nearly 50% increase in the demand for legal cannabis nationwide during the first year of the pandemic, they were not, legally speaking, essential workers. But in Florida, through medical cannabis, though medical cannabis was legal, recreational was not. Their ventures in the gray areas of the recreational weed industry are why they are only willing to be identified by their middle initials, CNS, and don't want the name of their business to be made public. Just as they were getting into a pandemic rhythm of deliveries and drop-offs, the George Floyd protests took over Tampa's streets. Every time C and S were driving after curfew, they felt as if they might be targeted by police, who were out in greater numbers. During one cannabis delivery, C noticed a car following him, and he worried it was driven by undercover police officers. Either that or counter-protesters, he couldn't tell. After the unmarked car was joined by five marked police vehicles, he told S, who was in the passenger seat with the delivery of edibles and flour, to throw everything out the window. Call their lawyer. Call their neighbor. The neighbor told him there were vehicles that looked like unmarked police cars in front of their house. Concerned about raids and arrests, they decided they had to leave town. For nearly a month, they stayed with friends, afraid to go home, and debated where they might go next. He wanted to move to the West Coast, someplace where the green rush was flush and legal. He had Los Angeles in mind, but she lobbied hard for New York. They both had relatives there, and a cannabis market was emerging in the city. When S lived in Boston, she used to take the Chinatown bus on the weekends to visit cousins or friends in New York. "I can be entertained by walking most of my day, having a coffee and just hanging out in a park," she says. "Those are the things that I really enjoy doing, and this is a city that's great for that." By July 2020, the couple arrived in New York after finding an Airbnb in, as C puts it, this awesome islands neighborhood. Everybody was barbecuing outside, listening to music, having the best time. New York was, he says, a breath of fresh air. Though cannabis is illegal at the federal level, it's legal for recreational use in 18 states and Washington, D.C., and for medical use in 37 states. New York made recreational cannabis legal in March 2021, less than a year after CNS moved to the city. From that point on, people 21 or older have been allowed to possess up to 3 ounces of cannabis for personal use and to keep up to 5 pounds of cannabis in their homes. Smoking cannabis is permitted almost everywhere you might smoke a cigarette, and police officers are no longer able to stop and search pedestrians only on the basis of smelling it on them. Legal sales from stores have had to wait, though. Recreational dispensaries are not yet operating legally. That will most likely begin happening by the end of this year. Still, spend 2 minutes in Washington Square Park, where passersby are offered memberships to cannabis clubs, and it's clear that the promised green rush is not on the horizon. It's here. Elsewhere around the city, entrepreneurs provide a gift of cannabis after a customer buys a work of art, say, or a t-shirt. A $365 prefix cannabis experience in Soho was advertised for Mother's Day on Talk, a restaurant website, as an 8-course, finely infused menu, Grand Cru and Premier Cru beverage pairings, German sparkling water. The defunct street art magazine Animal plans to start back up in June with cannabis distribution as part of its business model. If a city resident buys a weed-themed piece of art from the magazine, it will also deliver an ounce of free cannabis. Puff, Pass, and Paint gives BYOC classes where you can smoke while learning to paint. The business website Quartz has reported that legal cannabis sales in the United States are forecast to grow 14% a year on average and exceed $57 billion annually by 2030. And that's in only the states where such sales are already permitted. When you include the additional states poised to legalize cannabis, the national forecast exceeds $72 billion in sales. In New York, Mayor Eric Adams has proposed that the city invest $4.8 million next year in the local cannabis industry, which is expected to generate nearly $1.3 billion in the first year of legal sales. CNS arrived at just the right time, in other words. Chris Alexander, the executive director of the Office of Cannabis Management for New York State, says that based on the experience of other states that had legalized recreational cannabis, New York can expect an influx of travelers and workers to take advantage of a booming industry. "Our internal estimates are that there will be 60,000 jobs in the state," he says. "We'll see a wave on two sides, looking at sales and cultivation. We already have our small farmers growing. We have folks coming in to help with expertise." The reason it's taken so long for the dispensaries to open for recreational sales, maybe in part because the scandal that led to Andrew Cuomo's resignation as New York's governor last summer delayed Alexander's appointment, which in turn stalled the distribution of licenses for dispensaries and for clubs and lounges where people will be able to gather and smoke indoors. The process has also been affected by New York State's efforts to take equity into account, that is, to give priority to New Yorkers with past cannabis convictions when it assigns licenses. As the Times noted in 2018, Hispanic people across New York City had been arrested on low-level cannabis charges at five times the rates of white non-Hispanic people over the previous 3 years. In Manhattan, black people have been arrested at 15 times the rate of white people, even though surveys indicated that the rates of cannabis use were similar for both groups. The state now wants to try to make up for those disparities. It also seeks to remove as many barriers as possible for small business workers like CNS, who, as newcomers, won't get priority as a New York community member, Alexander says, but maybe they'll get priority because they're a minority-owned business. When CNS landed in the city, they didn't have a solid plan for selling cannabis in New York. They also didn't know if they could keep going in Tampa from afar. They worried about their legal risk there, for a time paused most of their Florida operations. They considered taking regular jobs. He spent a day answering phones at a crisis center hotline. She wanted to be a food blogger or a recipe developer. But nothing really clicked, and they soon decided to stick with their original idea, figuring out how to keep their brand afloat in Tampa while establishing a foothold in Brooklyn. One of the first tests the couple faced was the city's familiar hazing ritual, finding a place to live. We didn't have pay stubs and all these formal documents and papers that you typically need if you're going to get an apartment here, S says. But they had just enough cash coming in from Tampa, where they had friends making deliveries to their remaining customers, to rent an apartment in a largely Ecuadorian neighborhood in Brooklyn. My dad's Ecuadorian, C says. My family's Ecuadorian. In Miami, there's not that many Ecuadorian, so it was nice to be in a neighborhood where things that people talk about or say on the news that might be going on, I can kind of relate to. Once settled, they spent their life savings, thousands of dollars, to buy a package of cannabis from Colorado, hoping that would enable them to establish their New York business. It didn't. I've been selling marijuana since I was a teenager in Miami, C says. Every now and then, I would do a rookie mistake. This deal was one of them. They had planned to both sell the cannabis and use some of it for giveaways, which they thought would help them gain a following in Brooklyn. But it was lost in transport. They had to get cannabis on credit in order to have something to sell. During their first winter, C sold cannabis for a friend and then used his cut of the profits to buy more to sell on his own. I'd meet people up in the park, he says. I would serve up the taco workers. The couple was getting used to the new city, walking their dogs, eating at the same taco shop every day, letting the borough's rhythms dictate theirs. One of C's favorite aspects of the city life was sharing tacos and a smoke with neighbors at the end of the day. When legalization became official last year, they felt that their gamble had paid off. Less than a month later, they were ready to plan a 420 celebration, an event like the ones they used to put on in Tampa. They had become close with the owner of a taco truck, and together they organized something like a block party happy hour. Because that 420 observed as a cannabis holiday fell on Tuesday, they hit upon a Taco Tuesday twist. Free infusions as taco toppings. It was their Brooklyn debut. The success of the event and their growing love of Brooklyn increased their desire to give up selling at festivals and on corners. They wanted the heart of their business to be a brick-and-mortar store. After they found a small place, C explained to the landlord during negotiations that their company was a holistic lifestyle brand. The landlord seemed to like what he heard about the couple's desire to use cannabis to help people and be a part of the community. S was nervous about the financial commitment to the space, but they signed a 6-month lease anyway. Even if it stayed open for only a month, C says, they thought that would be worth it. They could get their name out there, get involved in their block, build community with a few people in the neighborhood. In the last year, S and C have become firmly entrenched in New York's underground cannabis culture. A few months after the opening of their store, they hosted a local fashion designer's pop-up show there. This January, they held a grow clinic over Zoom that 35 people attended. Some of C's favorite events are what he calls stash and dash competitions or scavenger hunts, for which he emails clues to club members who, on a specified night, dash through the city searching for free, hidden cannabis. These are not the only handouts. Sometimes they put out word that a free ounce is available outside the store. The first person to show up gets to keep it. It's kind of cool to see somebody get blessed with some deliciousness, C says. When I stopped by their store earlier this year, C was holding a joint. He apologized for the smoke fanning it away, but this was their 420 celebration, and he had a store to run, a party with a DJ out front, a block in Brooklyn to get high. "Today's mad crazy," he said. A coach baseball cap worn backward kept his shoulder-length hair out of his face, and a neck tattoo peaked above the collar of his sweatshirt. He and S were passing out free pre-rolls or already made joints and half-hugging neighbors and strangers alike. Pickup orders that were called in earlier were being handed out to customers over the counter in brown paper bags. S was giving directions to their three employees and calmly navigating the festivities. There were a dozen or so people in line, more than one of them dancing to the music from outside. S, wearing a cardigan draped over a t-shirt that clearly stated in Spanish her progressive feelings about immigration, showed off the store to me. It resembled a neighborhood wine shop or a boutique that sells locally sourced goods. One brick wall was painted white, with a couple of wooden shelves displaying CBD dog treats, paintings, tinctures. Their CBD oils were going for anywhere from $45 to $220, depending on strength and ingredients. Another wall was reserved for community art. Frame drawings, a mural, porcelain faces that serve as planters for cascading vines. All the money from the art sales goes directly to the artist, S told me. She pointed out t-shirts, hemp clothing, paintings, weavings, grow lights, and finally the elaborate communal rig, a glass apparatus that traps smoke from the THC concentrate called dab. Members, she explained, can stop by any time for a hit from the rig. They get one free hit a day. Membership is also free, though through an email sign-up. The store has almost 1,600 members. "Did you just burn through the last of the papaya?" she asked an employee working the counter, referring to a cannabis strain for sale. Its sweet aroma was wafting through the store. The employee nodded. "Dang, I was supposed to save it for..." She mumbled the customer's name, aware of my presence and the legal gray area they were still operating in. One evening, about a month later, I met C in Midtown at a residential 4-floor walk-up built in 1910. There was a freestanding ATM out front and a banner for members-only cannabis club. The building itself is home to two cannabis businesses. The club on the ground floor, run by a legacy operator who has been selling cannabis illegally for 15 years, and a grow house upstairs. The grow house is where C gets their cannabis. "My main goal is to have nothing but the New York product," he said. He wants to support the local industry from seed to smoke with cultivators, pickers, and rollers from the city, in part because he doesn't think that users elsewhere around the country appreciate the history of black market grows in New York. The sour diesel strain, for example, is thought to have originated in New York. When it reached Miami, and when C was a teenager, it was the only kind of cannabis he smoked. I have huge respect for New York growers and huge respect for the game out there. And it's really an honor to be part of all this. Though he wasn't sure how many places like the Midtown Grow House existed in the city, he guessed the number could be in the hundreds. Just in Chinatown alone, that's where most of the country gets the old school bubba, he said. The black market and the underground stretches beyond anybody's imagination. The particular grow house occupied the living rooms of 2 one-bedroom apartments. Danny, who goes by Danny Life, set up the operation 2 years ago. He showed me the 26 plants in the back apartment, which he expected to produce 12 pounds of cannabis every 10 weeks. Each plant, about 3 feet tall, had its own pot with a masking tape label that identified its strain, Cherry Lime Runt or Joker's Candy, for instance, and phenotype. Danny was reluctant to show me the plants in the front apartment because they weren't doing that well. The employee who had been tending them mistakenly pruned them back too far. While C and Danny shared a pre-roll, they were deep in conversation about the benefits of each strain and the preferred temperature, 75 to 80 degrees, relative humidity, high 50s, low 60s, in the flowering stage, and light for the plants, the last two variables of which Danny controls remotely on his phone. The grow house is only one part of Danny's business. He owns a farm in Oregon where he's licensed to grow medical cannabis, and a streetwear shop in Staten Island where he lives. When I asked Danny and C how they met, they both laughed. They couldn't remember at first, but then traced their connection back to a cannabis connoisseur who posted about Danny's events on Instagram. Danny told me his latest goal is to address a countrywide void, quality pre-rolls. Pre-rolls are tainted in the nationwide market because most people use their garbage material, their endings, their trim, he says. He wanted to produce 1,400 pre-rolls a day to sell wholesale at $5 each. He had just spent an entire shift that day, 9 to 5, working with his employees to, as he put it, roll cannolis. The plants, all female, would eventually be trimmed and harvested in early July. As Danny locked up the apartment, he whispered to the plants, "See you later. Love you, girls." Because he's deeply invested in weed. He's 33, but has spent 18 years in the industry so far. He's eager for everything to be officially legal. "I can't wait for my outpost to open. That's going to be lit," he said. Danny doesn't mind talking about his business publicly. He's already involved in several groups applying for licenses to grow and sell cannabis, and he's confident about his prospects. One project will be headquartered in a former bank in White Plains, a nearby suburb. At one point, he found himself with the White Plains mayor. "I'm Puerto Rican from New York City, sitting at the mayor's office, and I'm pushing weed," Danny told me, describing their meeting. The mayor asked Danny what his role was in the company. Danny said he told him about his industry expertise and added, "I'm the one who checks off every box as far as social equity." SNC hoped to get their own license next year, but the process has been slow and will probably be expensive, they worry. "We're trying to build a membership and really just go about it in the best way we can without stepping on anybody's toes," C says. "It's a delicate balance," he notes, trying to respect the work of activists who helped pass New York's cannabis legislation while also taking advantage of the market it's creating. The issue of equity matters to them. "Cannabis has a deep, dark history," he says, referring to the racial disparities in arrests for possession of cannabis in urban areas. He has seen it firsthand. "I come from Miami, so I get it. I want to make sure we do this in a certain way." After Danny left, C told me that he and S were just getting by with what they were making from their New York venture. all the giveaways, the events, the rent, the employees, taxes, it all adds up. Gross sales were high, but so were the costs of expanding their business. While their 420 party was a celebratory occasion, they had also just paid an extraordinary amount to the government. Their business may be operating in a legal gray area, but they're still subject to state and federal taxes, and they can't claim any write-offs. C was hoping that in 2 years, maybe five, whenever that license comes through, things might change. Then they'd be able to make money in Tampa and in New York. With a license, they could expand their offerings, open more stores. S could be the chef serving tasting menus. If they made enough, C thinks, maybe he'll share some of what he's learned about the cannabis industry with his relatives who still live in Ecuador and Colombia. And maybe his role will become more managerial, less hands-on. At the moment, it feels like he and S wear all the hats. He says, once we get a license and we're able to really do what we want without any limitations, then things will be different. We're just waiting for that moment. The author, Jamie Lowe, is a frequent contributor to the magazine and the author of Breathing Fire, Female Inmate Firefighters on the Front Lines of California's Wildfires. Continuing with the New York theme, what do we want from our next new New York? Decade after decade, waves of migration have remade New York. What kind of city will the latest one create? This is a story by Ismail Muhammad. First time I moved to New York, I was an undergraduate, and I tried to make Harlem my home. I had a lot to learn. As a Californian, I thought Chucks were year-round shoes. I wore them even in the snow, letting my toes get stiff on late-night walks from the library or the 116th Street station back to my dorm. By my sophomore year, though, I knew the most important things. Where on Malcolm X I could find the shea butter I needed to keep my skin from turning ashy in the winter, the barber shop where I could get a decent fade, and the grocery store where I could buy Red Rooster hot sauce. An earnest literature nerd, I was studying at Columbia because I wanted to be a writer, which meant being like the writers I read as a high school student, Larson, Hughes, Hurston, and that meant being in Harlem. So I found myself at Minton's Playhouse on 118th, or hanging out at St. Nicholas Park, or soaking up history by osmosis at the Studio Museum. I wanted to become part of Harlem's long cultural legacy, and the steady stream of arrivals who'd come to New York to transform themselves into who they were destined to be. This past winter, as I faced the prospect of returning to New York, after a decade in California's Bay Area, I knew I wanted Harlem to be my home again. If I was hoping for a return to the charming literary fantasy that sustained me as a college boy, though, I was out of luck. As I began my search for housing, a broker described the rental market as the worst he had witnessed in his long career. The pandemic, or at least the city's patience with fighting it, was coming to an end. My housing search pitched me headlong into a frenzied and undignified reality. Competitors greeted me at every open house I went to. Like me, they had trawled StreetEasy and Trulia and Craigslist. Like me, they'd been tempted by digitally placed furniture and airbrushed interiors, fooled by wide-angle photos of spacious living rooms that turned out to feel like crypts. Some eager people arrived clutching application packets, while others bid up the rent. One Saturday afternoon in March, I walked to see a fifth-floor walk-up, which a broker described as a sizable one-bedroom. It left me deflated. The wood floors subtly sloped toward the apartment's center, and the bedroom could snugly fit a full-size bed, maybe a small dresser, but nothing else. The bathroom was a closet. I could barely stand in the sole actual closet. When I asked if the dingy walls would be repainted before the unit was rented, the broker, a gangly Zoomer in a fur coat blinked at me. "No, that's not something the landlord will do," he said, before pointing out a neighborhood bar that he promised served bottomless mimosas at brunch. Eventually, I found a place just steps away from Harlem's heart at 125th Street. When I looked down from my living room onto the street below, the neighborhood's new motley character comes into view, people alternately sprawling and contracting as neighbors shuttle in and out of buildings, the quick steps of new-moneyed young professionals in contrast with the block's otherwise sleepy tempo. From this perch at the base of St. Nicholas Terrace, I can see how the neighborhood and the city itself have changed since I last lived in New York in 2011. The changes are being driven yet again by arrivals as an influx of new and returning residents jam themselves into the city. New Yorkers with means who fled during COVID are now returning to the upscale neighborhoods they abandoned. At the same time, the pandemic-era rent concessions and eviction protections that advantaged many renters, especially in the poorest neighborhoods where most residents stay put, have expired. Then there are the newcomers like me moving to the city in droves for work, repopulating the offices that are struggling to creep back to life. To make matters worse, over the next decade, the city has failed to construct new affordable housing commensurate with its growing population. The pandemic only exacerbated this gap. Throughout its modern history, Manhattan has been defined by masses of refugees, laborers, dreamers, millionaires, paupers, writers, actors, musicians, and all the rest arriving and charging into, up the length of, and eventually off the island. It's dawning on me that I'm now part of yet another kind of New York history, a wave of migration that would decide the city's future. New York is poised to revive itself after the suffering of 2020, but as with the pandemic itself, some will be able to weather recovery's onset better than others. As new migrations begin to change the city's population and culture, New Yorkers will be answering the same questions they've asked themselves for decades, or even centuries. What do we want this city to be, and whom do we want here? Arriving in New York might prompt dreams of literary stardom, indulgent luxury, or maybe just a good bottomless mimosa brunch. But in reality, arrival here has always been bound up with questions of power. Who gets to be where, when, and why? The answers are decided ad hoc by what the writer Lucy Santee has called Manhattan's great machinery of movement. And the ever-growing need for housing, above all, has served as that machine's engine. Upwardly mobile residents pushed their way north as newer immigrants and the poor settled in the abandoned neighborhoods. All parties acted on the faith that there would always be more space to settle, exploit, and eventually abandon to newcomers. For example, as Irish immigrants fleeing religious conflict and poverty in the early 19th century flowed into Manhattan, between the early 1820s and 1830s, the United States experienced a six-fold increase in Irish immigrants, with many of them settling in New York. Real estate barons like John Jacob Astor saw an opportunity. Houses could be subdivided into overcrowded tenement buildings, their floors turned into apartments for multiple families rather than a single renter. Areas like Five Points were multiracial ghettos where, at various points in history, Irish, German, Chinese, and African American migrants lived. By 1920, more than 2 million people living in New York were immigrants, many of them Eastern and Southern European origin. In the latter decades of the 19th century, overcrowding in Lower Manhattan and Midtown prompted the development of neighborhoods like Harlem, where real estate developers and reformers helped construct cheap apartment buildings for European immigrants. There's a great picture here of the caption says, back lots of New York tenements. around 1935, and it shows long strings of laundry on clotheslines, and it looks like the clotheslines are 30 or 40 feet long. The history of arrival is not just a story of development and coexistence, though. It's also a story of violent competition for control. Persistent race riots plagued Lower Manhattan, with blacks often becoming targets of the white working class and losing in the contest for living space. Riots in 1834, 1863, and 1900 encouraged black migration farther north. As David Levering Lewis writes in When Harlem Was in Vogue, by 1910, with the onset of World War I, hundreds of thousands of blacks poured out of the South and into northern cities in search of higher wages. Soon, an overwhelming majority of black New Yorkers had been born outside the city. Harlem was already prepared to welcome the influx. Black New Yorkers had been pushing north out of Midtown since the 1890s, and by 1910, large African-American churches purchased or built new buildings for their congregations. The congregants followed. 1911, St. Philip's Episcopal Church purchased a block of apartment buildings on 135th Street. The cabarets and jazz clubs in Midtown that helped pioneer America's obsession with black music weren't far behind. Buoyed by economic gains that made during World War I, some black New Yorkers found the security that had eluded them downtown. In a surreal 1925 short story by Ruta Fisher, City of Refuge, the story's protagonist, a southern migrant fresh off the subway, experiences Harlem as a utopia where his rights are truly inalienable. Everyone has money, and a black traffic cop can lord his authority over a white driver. The story is a delirious representation of the relative freedom southern migrants encountered in Harlem. What was previously an enclave for European immigrants had transformed into a black Mecca by 1920. Harlem's reputation as a neighborhood with strong cultural and social infrastructure put it at black culture's vanguard. Figures like the scholar W.E.B. Du Bois, the sociologist Charles S. Johnson, and the philosopher Alain Locke envisioned culture as the ideal way to assault anti-black racism. Harlem was their staging ground. These members of the black intellectual elite, with the support of wealthy patrons, both black and white, engineered the Harlem Renaissance. Johnson recruited talented artists, luring writers and artists like the Kansas City-based painter Aaron Douglas and Zora Neale Hurston, at the time a Harvard University student, to New York with promises of a budding scene and recognition for their work. Publications like Du Bois' magazine, The Crisis, highlighted voices from the movement, while Locke's 1925 anthology, The New Negro, tried to codify it. Voices from farther afield like Pan-Africanist Marcus Garvey and the poet Claude McKay, both from Jamaica, drifted in and out of the Renaissance, but found their perspectives amplified on Harlem streets and in its publications. The foundation for a century of black culture was laid in New York. Like many of New York's cultural explosions, the Harlem Renaissance depended on the availability of living space not only for the artists who drove the movement, but also for the masses whose culture allowed for high art to flourish at all. In most cases, the fact that New York's wealthy elite abandoned entire neighborhoods left the poor and low caste to create new cultural forms that invigorated the city. In her book, The Warhol Economy, the writer Elizabeth Curd Halkett looked to the downtown New York boom of the 1970s and found the same logic at work. Capital's abandonment of New York and shredding of the social contract made the city a dangerous place to live, but it also created the conditions, cheap rent and plenty of space, primarily, that gave us punk music, hip-hop, street art, and other pillars of contemporary American culture. Generations earlier, the crowded and dangerous conditions of the Bowery gave rise to figures like the composer Irving Berlin, who, before he was a Broadway luminary, got his start singing weepy ballads to crooks in seedy dives. In the mid-1970s, the blight of New York's downtown scene, the delirious cross-pollination of daring music, visual art and fashion, birthed musicians like Patti Smith and artists like Keith Haring. Around the same time, hip-hop culture was taking root in the ruins of the South Bronx. The Haitian-Puerto Rican-American artist Jean-Michel Basquiat bridged the gap between uptown and downtown, concocting a splintered style that spoke to the decade's social disintegration. Today's housing market provides a different challenge for the recession from the recession of the 1970s, though. 20th century Manhattan was a city in which arrivals could reliably find a place for themselves, no matter how abject or ignored that place was. 21st century Manhattan presents an altogether different set of problems. How can new arrivals make a home here if there is no affordable space for them? How can they transplant themselves without exiling the working class natives whose culture and labor the city cannot survive without? Returning to Harlem meant arriving again, finding myself looking at the area through its history rather than through a fantasy. When I was a freshman at Columbia, students railed against construction of the university's Manhattanville campus in West Harlem. The plan was reminiscent of the conflict in 1968 over Columbia's ill-fated attempt to build a segregated gym in Morningside Park, where Harlemites felt would result in their exclusion from crucial neighborhood public space. When I was in school, students conducted a hunger strike against the plans, but the first phase of the Manhattanville project was completed earlier this year. A Whole Foods opened on 125th Street back in 2017, as if in anticipation of the changes Columbia's project would bring. The presence of highly educated, upwardly mobile people who would begin to colonize uptown rather than compete in Brooklyn's overheated market or suffer the absurdities downtown and in the process taking apartments that, until recently, might have served a more working-class group of renters. My return to Harlem speaks to the paradox at the heart of contemporary New York. The city's warm embrace of the creative economy's stewards make it what it is. Increasingly, that embrace leaves too many other residents out in the cold. The author Ismail Muhammad is a story editor for the magazine. I'll read from The Ethicist. I witnessed a murder. Is it wrong to write about it? The magazine's ethicist comments on whether we have the right to tell the story of someone else's tragedy. This is by Kwame Anthony Appiah. Recently, I rented a private office in a co-working space so I could work on personal writing projects. About 2 weeks into my tenure, I heard screams. When I went to investigate, I saw a man beating someone savagely with a metal pipe. I ran to my office, called 911, and then returned, only to see the man walking in my direction. I ran back to my office and hid until the police arrived. The victim, she was the office manager, was rushed to the hospital where she was declared dead. The story that emerges is that the man, a fellow client who had been living in his office, was being evicted by the office manager. Because I'm a writer, it's not surprising that a number of my friends, writers and non-writers alike, have asked whether I am writing about this story. And from the beginning, I have struggled to even talk about what I witnessed. I don't want to dine out on it. Feels unseemly to me, if not outright wrong, to take advantage of my very accidental connection to this murder and its victim. I'm troubled by the idea of viewing another woman's death as material. What are the ethics of writing about what is, at heart, somebody else's tragedy? And Appiah writes, "It's worth recalling that tragedy, a word we use to describe events like this one, originally designated a literary genre, a form of storytelling. Whatever is going on in us when we experience a tragic event, Aristotle wasn't the last to speculate about it, we surely learn something about our own emotional repertory. It may serve as a rehearsal of our responses to actual horrors. Classic novels have taken inspiration from real homicides. Nonfiction works immortalizing such events have joined the literary canon. We dream in narrative, daydream in narrative, remember, anticipate, hope, despair, believe, doubt, plan, revise, criticize, construct, gossip, learn, hate, and love by narrative," the literary scholar Barbara Hardy maintained. In order to really to live, we make up stories about ourselves and others, about the personal as well as the social past and future. But to whom does the story of a homicide belong? Is it shared by the perpetrator and the victim? Is it inherited as part of someone's estate, like a piece of property? Is it a possession only of those who cared deeply about the life that was taken or about the person who took it? Whose is it? We'll do better, in my view, if we don't think about what happened as someone's possession. To regard what happened merely as material for your writing, to be sure, would be to lose track of the fact that it was an event in which another human being suffered terribly and died. And it's a natural anxiety that the friends and family of the murdered woman would be pained by what you might write. Yet they don't own the event. Indeed, there's a sense in which it really did happen to you as well. Certainly, your own experience, at once accidental and terrifying, was unique. Intimacy with your principles can be valuable for a writer. So can distance. That's because there's no single way of narrating an event, however banal, however horrific, and nobody has the lived experience of having been killed. Writing about the event you witnessed will be justified if what you write has value." And I'll read another letter to the ethicist. "My elderly mother lives halfway across the country. Her eyesight is impaired, but she's otherwise very healthy and lively. She lives independently and has managed to stretch her modest financial resources to last for 3 decades since my father died. My brother lives in the same town as my mother. He's been battling depression for many years. He's on medication, sees a therapist, but he has been unemployed for several years and receives no public assistance. He lives in a nice apartment, drives a nice car, and has lots of stuff. My mother supports him by depositing money directly into his account. We don't know how much money she has left. She doesn't like to talk about finances, but it can't be much, as my parents were never wealthy. My mother and the rest of us avoid confronting my brother about his situation. He tends to blow up and get very angry and emotional when we do so. His depression apparently keeps him from applying for benefits or seeking even part-time employment, although we've all encouraged him to take those steps. I'm worried about making it too easy for him to continue in his current situation, and I'm not comfortable giving him money directly. I'm also concerned that he may have racked up a huge amount of credit card debt buying things he doesn't need. I send my money to my mother from time to time, but I have serious qualms about doing so because the funds I send to her end up going toward maintaining my brother. How can I reconcile my desire to help my mother financially with my frustration about my inability to change my brother's unsustainable situation?" Depression may not be a full accounting of your brother's condition. Psychiatric research suggests that people with personality disorders, as you might find in people who respond to well-intended efforts to help with outbursts of rage or who are spendthrift with other people's limited resources, often struggle with major depression too. but we can leave diagnosis for the professionals. The point is that you've concluded your brother won't change his habits so long as he can depend on your mother's support, and that in the longer term, your mother can't really afford to keep it up. Those are real concerns. Your mother may, like many elderly people, come to need daily assistance of some sort. And whether it involves home caregivers or a move to a facility, that's likely to increase her expenses. Neither she nor your brother is facing up to the possibility that her funds will run out at some point. Given the risk of a dire outcome, your mother's reluctance to discuss her finances isn't a sufficient reason not to press her for a sense of her circumstances. If she's embarrassed to discuss these things with family, perhaps you could persuade her to talk to a financial planner. You refer to other family members. You could all work together to make this happen. It would be good, too, if you could join forces to improve your brother's situation. There are public programs, including the disability benefits provided by the Social Security Administration and by Medicaid, that are set up to help those who, owing to their physical or mental condition, are unable to hold a job. A legal professional might be able to figure out how he could receive what other benefits he's legally eligible for rather than living off someone on a fixed income. You say he responds badly to family interventions. You might seek family counseling in order to help you all sort through what's going on. All of you have your reasons for letting things coast. Your brother will blow up. Your mother will shut down. It'll be unpleasant in a dozen ways. But all of you have stronger reasons for heading off a disaster. So here's a tip. Would your pet make a good therapy animal? Shy animals are ill-suited for the job. This is by Malia Wallen. Ask yourself, does your animal genuinely love to be loved? Says Tina Mitchell, a coordinator of volunteers for the Animal Assisted Therapy Program at the San Francisco Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. Mitchell and her colleagues train and certify dogs, cats, rabbits, pigs, and horses to comfort strangers in hospitals, nursing homes, senior centers, psychiatric facilities, schools, and airports. Graduates of the program include Alex the Great, a 28-pound Flemish giant rabbit, and a miniature pig named Lilu. To be a therapy animal, your pet needs to first master basic manners, including control of bodily functions and adherence to sit, stay, and leave it commands. Rabbits and cats are exempt from this requirement. To assess candidates, Mitchell and her colleagues start by handling and hugging the animals, touching their feet and paws while looking for signs of unease. If an animal shows any signs of fear when surrounded by unknown people wanting to touch them, they're probably ill-suited for the job. Your pet should remain unfazed by wheelchairs, walkers, canes, loud music, small children, and other animals. Never force the role of therapist on a shy animal. Volunteers often bring their pets into the SPCA to be certified because they've noticed the calming effects the creature seems to have out in the world. Research shows that animals confer all kinds of physical and emotional benefits on humans. In a recent clinical trial of emergency room patients at the Royal University Hospital in Saskatchewan, participants who received a 10-minute visit from a therapy dog reported small but statistically significant decreases in pain, as well as lowered anxiety and depression symptoms. An animal wearing a vest that reads, "Pet Me," might be touched by hundreds of people during a 90-minute session at San Francisco International Airport. Always look for signs of exhaustion and make sure to provide adequate restroom breaks. Keep your animal on a leash or a harness. Remember that you are not the main attraction. You're there to facilitate a safe and inviting space for one species to soothe another. Don't initiate an interaction, even if you spot someone who appears perturbed or in need of soothing. Instead, let the person see your animal and approach it only if he or she is drawn to it. Some people may just not like animals, Mitchell said. That's okay. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.